The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
And welcome to the Rugby Rant, everybody. I'm the big guy, Scott Ferraro. With me is Rob, the Hammer Hammerschmidt. And it's that time again, Wednesday night. We have a run, pass, or kick. With the new year, we have a brand new run, pass, or kick episode. But before we get started, I want to talk to you all about our friends at therugbyshop.com. Besides having all the MLR merch you could ever want, they have helped us come out with the new line of Murdered Out Rugby Rant swag. We're talking hats. We're talking hoodies. We're talking the new Hammer tee. The Hammer has its own exclusive t-shirt. With happiness is a good ruck on the front and old school rake marks on the back. So you guys should go to therugbyshop.com, find the Rugby Rant gear under clubs, and use the code RugbyRant20 to get 20% off all Rugby Rant merchandise through January. Again, you get 20% off all Rugby Rant merchandise through January at therugbyshop.com when you use the code RugbyRant. So now I'm going to introduce our guest. We're very excited to have him. I know Ron's excited. You know, Rob has had a couple personal friends on the show recently, and he's killing us with guests. Rob is really killing the guest game right now in booking. So I'm going to give you his CV real quick. He started the Kenya Rugby Union. He managed the Kenyan national teams, both the 15s and the 7s. Former coach of the Chicago Blaze RFC, which obviously, as you guys know, Rob is affiliated with, and also coached the Chicago Sirens women's rugby team. I'd like to introduce Ronald Bacuzzi. Ronald, say hello to everybody.
Hi, everyone. Good to be here. I look forward to our chat tonight.
Awesome. So, you know, we have our run, pass, or kick, and I'm sure some of you guys are new and don't know how it goes down. So, Rob, why don't you tell them how run, pass, or kick works?
Okay, for the uninitiated, run, pass, or kick works like this. It's a different new style of asking interview questions than any other podcast out there, because we allow some options. Like any good rugby player, you got to have options. We're going to give Ronald some options today. And the options are run, pass, or kick. So, Ronald, we're going to ask you a question, prompt it with run, pass, or kick, and you just tell us what you're going to do. If you're going to run with a question, that means you're going to answer it straight away. If you're going to pass a question, it means it's just a little hot one. You don't want to answer it, don't want to get in trouble with it, so you're going to go ahead and pass on it. Or you can have a little fun with us, put us on the back foot, put us on the defensive, and you're going to kick the question to us. If you don't identify who you're going to kick it to, we'll assume it's whoever asked you the question. But you can also play a little game and name the individual that you're going to kick it to. And we have to answer in a way that we think you would answer. And you can even grade us out. You can tell us we were horrible. You can tell us that's a pretty good answer. You can even expound upon it a little bit. So, Ronald, are you ready for the run, pass, or kick challenge?
I'm ready to go.
Awesome. And it's good to have you on. We've shared a lot of laughs and had a great time over the years. So it's great to have you on the show. So I'm gonna harken back to that a little bit with the first question. And run, pass, or kick. Rumor has it that in your first season, or one of your first seasons coaching in the United States, you had a rather challenging experience with a player during a match. Is it true that as a result of that, you banned players' wives from attending games?
Run, I must talk about this. That's a great person. That's a great question, because the person in question was actually sitting right there. He's called Hammer.
So you're telling me you suspended Mrs. Hammerschmidt from coming to matches? Is that what happened?
Yes. She showed up. We were playing this game. It was a really nice game. I thought we were doing pretty well. And, you know, team was running. I think I can't remember what the score was, what was happening. But anyway, at halftime, we gather in the middle of the pitch. Guys have gone off to either side to coaches talk to them. And I'm standing with my guys. And in comes Mrs. Hammer. And and she whispers something to the guy. Right? So and then she runs back off. She's really, really excited about the news she was telling him. I don't know if I can say this on air, Hammer, or whether... Okay, I'm not going to get in trouble with her or anything.
Nah.
Okay, good. So Hammer, like, goes off into a daze. Like, what's going on? We go back into second half, and this guy's game is... His head is not in the game. So I keep wondering, what on earth is going on here? So I pull him off, and I ask him, Hammer, what's up? And he says, my wife's pregnant.
Because that's the perfect time. It's the perfect. I mean, if you're going to tell anybody, halftime during a game, and I'm sure the first half he played great. The first half was probably the greatest half of rugby he ever played.
Yeah. So he says, my wife's pregnant. So I think, what on earth is this? I mean, you can't do this at halftime. Why don't you wait until after the game or whatever? But anyway, I saw the kid the other day. What, 6'4" or something like that, tall beanpole. I saw him in class once, and I thought, ha, that guy looks like Hammer. When I talked to Hammer, he said, yeah, that was him.
That's so funny. Yeah, that's a great...
That was my first meeting with Mrs. Hammer. Yeah. Yeah, I hope she doesn't take me out on this or anything, because I asked you for permission. Remember that.
Yeah. Well, Ronald, 25 years of marriage, she's developed very thick skin. She's put up with my nonsense and BS for a long time. You're pretty safe. And that's a shout out to my younger son, Jackson. We talk a lot about Preston, but that was my man, J-Man, who's an awesome kid. And Ronald shared that story with me recently, and I'd never heard him tell it before. And it brought me to tears because it brought back some great memories.
Yeah, well, after that, you can't come with your girlfriend or wife. You know, half time, stay on the side of the pitch. Nobody else is allowed on the pitch. We don't want any funny news coming out.
Oh, my God. That's yeah. Great. You know, that's a huge challenge, because now, you know, if you know, maybe the next match Rob got taken out, you know, maybe Mrs. Tanner comes on the field for retribution, you know?
And by the way, I told her this story, Ronald, after you shared it with me.
Right.
And she goes, I was so mad at you that you didn't want to talk to me at halftime. I was so mad. And I was sitting there telling Preston he's going to have a baby brother, and you didn't want to talk to me because you were too busy on the rugby field.
Oh, my God.
That's great. I got the business all over again. It was horrible.
Oh, that's hysterical. Oh, my God. So Ronald, speaking of challenges, as we mentioned in your CV, you had managed both the 15s and the 7s Kenyan national team. So, you know, when you came to the U.S., run, pass, or kick, what was the biggest adjustment you made when you started coaching the Chicago Blaze? Like, you know, you had – obviously, you went from forming and molding a national team set up in 15s and 7s. To come coach a guy like Rob Hammerschmidt. So what, run, pass, or kick? What was your biggest adjustment?
I'll run with that one too. The biggest adjustment was actually adjusting my thinking, because rugby at that time was a lot more social at the Chicago Blaze. So guys would come out and they'd practice when they, you know, twice a week, but they didn't put in that intensity. They didn't think that much about it. And yeah, we're out to have a good time. Saturday after the game, let's have a couple of beers and then we move on. And then that's it till the next practice session. But the environment I had come from, we were almost semi-professional, where everybody was so focused on the game and we were all thinking about strategy, we're all thinking about technique, we're thinking about skill, opposition, and all that stuff. So I came with that mindset and I kept thinking, you know, these guys could be better than they are right now. And it was a bit of an adjustment. I think I coached there, to be honest, 4 years. And the first year, we lost all our games apart from the last one. It's a wonder that I actually was retained to coach the second year around, because most coaches would be done at the end of the first year. They say, look, obviously, you're no good. So, so get out and go. But then I'm also proud to say that over the next 3 years, I think we lost probably about 2 or 3 games. And we were beating people regularly by 40 points. So it was a matter of simply adjusting our thinking to match at some point, to take them higher from where they were, and for myself to come down to their level of thinking, and then working together to, you know, take on whoever else we came up with, we took on.
You know, it's funny, Ronald, I distinctly recall when you first came on board, it was really the first time. And keep in mind, for most fans out there, you know, I was very similar to a lot of rugby playing guys, you know, at club teams, where I'd come into it late in life, right? I'd not grown up playing rugby and understanding and learning strategy and learning defensive structures and things like that. So when Ronald came in, coming from the environment he had come from, into a D2 men's club, and this isn't disrespectful to any of the other coaches, but we started having chalk talks. We started putting up, diagramming the field, showing what we wanted to do, what our structures, offensive and defensive, were going to look like. And for me, and I can imagine some of my teammates, it was new and it was different. I think that's why we struggled that first year, because there was some adaptation that we had to do in those first, you know, that first season. And we came around once we understood where Ronald wanted to take us.
But the actually other important thing about that was, and we'll talk about this later as we go on, hopefully, is the environment I came from, everybody sort of knew what was going on. So you learn to take things for granted. You know, they know how to kick. When you talk about a pass, when you talk about a spiral pass or a torpedo kick, people know what that is. And then you come into this environment where the foundational skills were not so good. But then you have to coach all over again and ask yourself, so what really goes into a pass? What really goes into a kick? When you say take somebody out, it doesn't mean you kill him, you know? Some people would say, when you say take that guy out, they think, okay, I'll take him out. And boom, they take, no, that's not what I mean. I mean, take him out of the way and open the space for somebody else to come in. A lot of stuff that we went through, but I had a great time. I loved coaching the Blaze. And then they grew a little more, I mean, a little intense, quite intense. So everybody now was thinking about the game all the time. You know, and I thought, hey, you were supposed to be a relaxed club. So how come now, how come we're getting this level of intensity? But they're a great bunch of guys. I still keep in touch with a number of them.
Oh, absolutely. And it was a pleasure having you as a coach, for sure, Ronald. I want to move forward in the conversation a little bit. You came from the Kenyan Rugby Union. So you obviously, as a CEO, the manager of the union, you clearly understand relationships with world rugby. You understand what it's like to compete with the tier one teams and what kind of daunting task that can be. So let me preface the question a little bit. Just recently, Amazon, and you and I have talked a little bit about this, released a documentary by Dan Leo called Oceans Apart. Scott actually turned me on to it, so thank you, big guy. Throughout the film, Dan addresses the problems that plague Pacific rugby nations like Samoa. One of these is the lack of revenue sharing with Tier 1 nations. So as a director of rugby, as a CEO, Run, Pass, or Kick, does the RFU and World Rugby exacerbate the inequities that exist in you know, the rugby structure, world rugby structure?
I'll take a stab at it. I'll run with it. I'll take a stab at that, at the risk of answering both and not answering both questions at the same time. You have to look at it from two different mindsets. Rugby changed in 1995, because before 1995, we were fully almost quote-unquote amateur. I say amateur in the sense that people weren't paid to play. A lot of people were paid, but it was under the table. Then 1995, we came after the World Cup in South Africa. Then rugby turned professional, and now athletes were actually paid to play. Now, once you become a professional, you become a product, and people put money into a product that attracts eyeballs, I guess, to the screen. You know, people want to come and watch, so you want to be as good as you possibly can. The model I think that World Rugby took was sort of based on what FA, the professional leagues, took on, whether it was NFL or NBA or the FA Cup, the Premiership in the UK. They tried to take that model and think it was, you can't just adapt it and say, we'll take it out of here and put it into here. You know, I was going to say round square. You don't have a round square. you know what I mean anyway.
Square peg in a round, hole.
Yeah. There you go. That's what I was just talking about. You can't do that. You have to adapt to that for that to fit. So then you have you get into you have to start adapting to the new situation you find yourself in. People want to come and play. So now you start selling the players as products. Right now, if you go to the Pacific Islands, Pacific Islands have some of the best rugby players in the world. But because of their rugby economy, it's not that big. It's not that good. You go to an island like Tonga, maybe. Tonga has got, 800,000 people in total? But they have some of the biggest rugby players. But if you look at their national GDP, and they can't afford to run a professional rugby team. In fact, when the National Sevens, the World Sevens Series started, because Fiji was such a powerful force in world rugby, they took one event there, but they couldn't hold the second one there because it just costs too much. You're not able to support it. So world economies, country economies that host rugby matches actually have to have a lot of money to be able to manage that. New Zealand went to play in Samoa once and left Samoa with a debt of $1 million, yet it would have been nice to go and play there. But just to go and play, the sort of things Samoa had to do is not what they can do naturally because the economy doesn't support it. You have to have a much more vibrant economy to be able to run a vibrant professional sports team, not just rugby alone. Now, the challenge with world rugby is you have the home unions, the guys, England, Ireland, Scotland, and Britain.
Wales,
yeah, right? Who, supposedly spread rugby across the globe. And as far as they're concerned, rugby belongs to them. But rugby is changing now, and it's spreading all over the place through a variety of tournaments they're having, like the women's rugby, the World Sevens Series and stuff. So it's a little more open to a lot more people. Now, I don't know if I'm answering your question or I'm just going off.
It's I'm enjoying the conversation.
I think that the way world rugby is run, exacerbates that inequity. And I think Dan Leo shows that as far as revenue streams and saying that only whoever takes the home match takes the revenue, knowing that, you're never going to have a big tier one team go, one of those Pacific Islands to play because they're not going to get the draw. And it's going to cost. Now, I'm sure New Zealand, it costs them money. No,
they will get the draw. They won't get the money.
Correct.
Get the draw because the crowd will be packed. Witness when Australia came here or when New Zealand came to Chicago to play, people flew in from all over the place. But the city and the country and the RFU, the economy could actually sustain it, right? So they probably got some money back and they got sponsors to sponsor the thing and everything. But when you go to a smaller country, then yes, you will have people because there are people who are rugby mad and these are guys we watch on television. They've come in to play. Mm-hmm. But they may not be able to pay the $300-$400 a ticket to get in to sit in the stands. See, the economy just can't sustain it.
Yep.
Somehow. The tricky bit, I think what you're asking is, so when they go, can these guys go and pay them to, or split the money, whatever monies they will raise?
Yeah.
Because one of the things I would imagine is I would come and tell you, I'm coming to play at the Chicago Blaze. I say, Chicago Blaze, can you guarantee me at least 30% of the gate? Can you guarantee me you're going to get 20,000 people into the gate and each one of them is going to pay so much? Can you guarantee you're going to have TV rights? Can you guarantee you're going to have all that stuff? Because people will wake up at night to watch and play. Mm-hmm. And guarantees you need to have.
And you can kind of equate it back to the U.S. and in college football. And obviously, I grew up with football. A lot of these big Division I schools in football, they pay the first couple games. They'll pay a team to come in, a couple million dollars to play and get their butt kicked. But you know what? That team now has that money to use on facilities or on, whatever they need, whatever they can work it on. And you can see that model works because now you have teams like this year in college football, Coastal Carolina came up and was ranked in the top 20. And they had been one of those teams perennially that plays in Alabama or Florida or an LSU for several years and gets these, $1 million. Now all of a sudden their facilities are top tier because they kind of went through that gauntlet.
Just to hang on. When I was at the KRU, we actually went over to play in our 15-a-side team went to play in Brazil. But in order for us to travel to Brazil to play, which is across two continents almost, we had to get a stipend from World Rugby, who said that we're going to pay you, we're going to give you 50% of your cost. How much is it going to cost you? Let's take the figure. Let me say $20,000. Mm-hmm. Right. So they say, okay, fine. We're going to give you $10,000. You raise the rest so that you can go and play and come back. Right. So they gave us the 10,000. Now we have to run around and look for the 10,000 to enable us to fly all the way to Brazil and come all the way back. Now, part of the problem is the $10,000 then cheats you that you're able to raise the next 10,000. Yeah. Then you find raising the next 10,000 is a lot more difficult.
Yeah, then you
but now you have but now you have an obligation to World Rugby mm-hmm. to go and play because we've given you the money. Yeah. So you probably go into debt. Yep. Right?
Yes,
fly over to Brazil, come back and play and stuff. It's a chicken and egg because you really want to raise your profile and raise your ranking and, you know, play a much higher tier mm-hmm. game, but you're not able to afford it at the way it's going right now.
No, that's I completely believe that. And I see how World Rugby can kind of maybe entice some of these unions who are looking to do that and try and get into those top tiers and trying to hit that competition by throwing that egg at you and say, hey, we're going to do that 50%. And I can completely see how you want to take it, you make the obligation. And then, like you said, you're just kind of sitting there going.
But I wouldn't say enticing. I think enticing is a difficult word because they want to spread the game. And so from their perspective, we're helping you out. I'm going to give you 50% of your cost. Now you raise the rest. Right. And then because you really want to play, you say, yeah. I'm going to try my best to raise that cash.
I know. But I think we have seen historically now, like and you said it just before, you go into debt trying to get that other 50%. So, yes, you know, World Rugby's OK, I guess enticing is the wrong word. It seems like they're trying to help out. But obviously that hasn't been the best option because now you're running into debt to go play that match. So,
yeah, you know, it doesn't quite work. From a player's perspective, they love it. From the country's perspective, they love it and they were playing at this level. But from an administration perspective and finance in the background, you're just thinking, oh no, we can't do this. But hey, are you going to stand up and tell people we're not going to go to Brazil because we can't afford it? And somebody's going to say, but you were given half the cost. So what's the problem? You can raise the rest.
Yeah.
And then you run into all sorts of issues. You have to look for sponsors, stuff.
Yep. No, it's definitely, I can only imagine trying to one. I know you were talking to us before we went on air and you were saying how you helped create the union and you were kind of like a one man army when you first got there. And then when you got back, it had spread and grown a little bit, but I can only imagine being the one guy doing everything, for an entire country's union. It's giving me anxiety talking about it. So I can only imagine what you went through. Real quick. Our next question is actually from our buddy Ty, who couldn't be with us. He just sent it in on Facebook. He said, countries like Madagascar regularly get 20,000 people in attendance at their rugby games. Should World Rugby be looking in more in Africa to grow the rugby market?
Madagascar is a fun place to play because that's their national sport. So everybody will show up to play. And the big question is, when you talk about going to Africa is a growing market, but at the same time, it's the same problem of, do you actually have the money and do you have the interest for people to go and play? I know that there have been national games played in various countries and there's been no gate fee, but nobody shows up. So the guys who are playing, you're playing a national game, right? Country versus country. I don't want to name them, but there's nobody in the stadium. The gates are wide open. Just walk in when you feel like, sit down and watch. It doesn't happen. So you have to look at the different rugby economies around the world and say, okay, here it can work and there it may not work. Going into play, you're obviously going into competition, then you want to go and play at a higher level. The higher you go, the more it costs. I mean, Hammer, if you remember, when we were playing around our little village there in Lamont, it's easy to drive down Chicago and somewhere else, go play Lincoln Park, go play in Schaumburg, go play, you know, all those little teams. Mm-hmm. But the moment you tell guys, now we're going to go to Kentucky to play somewhere there, then everybody starts saying, uh-oh, I'm sorry, I can't make it I have to work. I can't get time off or this, that, and the other. I just can't afford it. And maybe you're just asking a guy for another couple of $100.
Or my wife's pregnant.
Or your wife's pregnant. I can't go. See? So, all those issues come into play. Then if you're playing a country that's professional, it's different because they're always there. That's what they get up in the morning to do. But for most of the countries in Africa, you're fully amateur, so people play when they have the time, which is basically after work or over weekends. So going to play in an international game, you've got to take time off work and stuff. And how many days is your employer going to give you off to say you're going on a jaunt in the sun?
I hear that. I think Rob's up next with the next question here.
So I'm gonna move forward. With all that being said, and we recently saw that Moana Pacifica and the New Zealand based and the New Zealand Maoris played one another just in November. So is the Moana Pacifica run, pass, or kick? Is Moana Pacifica and a New Zealand based Pacifica Super Rugby team a solution to providing opportunities for Pacific Island players to get paid more money and kind of stay in the Pacific Islands?
Those are really,
you get your run, pass, or kick on this one.
Yeah. Let me kick it to Scott. Let's hear what he has to say.
I think it's a good idea to have a team, but my fear is, it's a fear on the developmental side, is you're going to have a lot of maybe got top tier guys who want to go, going to come back and play for that team that are in the Prem or they're in, you know, Pro 14 or something like that. And then, so you're still stifling some of those players who might not be able to get a contract in Europe. So I'm wondering if it's going to kind of snuff out its own development, if those players come back. But obviously I think any team that's going to try and support this Pacific Island community, especially trying to get them, one, obviously playing under in televised games in professional contracts, is always going to help them, because they again, most of their opportunities have been outside of, you know, that area. But again, I don't know if some of those top players are going to come back and want to play. You know what I mean? Like I could see where it becomes, a player on, let's say, Saracens wants to come back and take that spot. And then you had a young kid who maybe doesn't have enough film or doesn't have enough experience to go and play in the Prem, and you're kind of losing that touch of that market. So I think you're going to have a good and bad team. I think you're going to definitely have to manage which players you want to select to be on that team. You know, I think it comes down to player management.
My only concern, I think, with like a because they've talked about an Auckland based Pacifica team in the Super League, you know, playing in the New Zealand and in Australia League. My only concern with that is that it's not going to bring revenue into any of those Pacific Islands, right? I mean, a lot of that revenue, even with the gate, is going to be focused on New Zealand if it's based upon New Zealand. So at what point does it become successful enough in which you can move a team to Napier or move it to one of the other island, countries and or maybe even rotate so that it kind of spreads a little bit of that the wealth to the economies.
I'm going to answer that from a development perspective. The revenue is a good thing. Having the team is a good thing. But from a development perspective, how does it help the players in their native countries to actually grow? There's got to be a pathway for them to get there. You have to have a pathway where those guys grow and they know that's their target. We want to get to this Maori Pacifica team so that I'm not going to the UK, but I'm coming to play for these guys. And then I can use that as my springboard to get into other teams wherever I'm going. If you don't have that structure, it doesn't matter what you say, because right now what we have is we're looking at the icing on the cake right on the top. And this is my opinion. You're looking at the icing at the top and it looks very nice. You know, let's have that. But then when those guys move on, then what happens? You're going to have to pick somebody else. But where is he going to come from? You've got to have a train coming through, you know, of little new players. Like Scott was saying, that guy who doesn't want to come back, who's going to replace him? Mm-hmm. See, because right now the it looks like the journey is play for your native country, then go to Europe or go to New Zealand or go to Australia and then come back and play. Mm-hmm. You see? Whereas it should be the other way, where you come out, play for this team, and then move off to somewhere else. And you have stronger roots, and people say, that's the guy I want to be like.
Yeah, that Moana Pacifica team should springboard you.
Yeah, he grew up right next to me. I know who he is. Mm-hmm. Not that he took off and then he came back, and I see him only when it's off season.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, it's tough, and only having one team like that and make it New Zealand based, as Rob was talking about, I think administratively is a challenge. And again, the revenue is not going back to the island community. So maybe it's one of those things where you have to get enough investors to have two or three of these teams And that way you have that large amount represented there. And you can then say, oh, there's a team on each of these islands. So it does make sense for us to go and play, you know, a match and a match here. And you can kind of fit it in. And MLR is doing that with some of their Northeastern teams where they're saying, okay, go play, you know, 4 or 5 of your away matches, you know, in February, March that are going to be in the South or the West Coast. So that way the crowds are better because you have better weather, you know? So I think if you can get enough investors to get a couple teams to do that, then you're setting yourself up to put those teams where you need them to be and they can get the revenue. So actually the next question is actually MLR focused, Ron. So this week on the MLR Fan Zone, a fan had questioned why Carlin Isles has not been picked up by an MLR team. You guys can hear what I have to say about it in next week's episode of the rant. But we also know that Blitzbach legend CSL Africa is going to be playing for San Diego Legion this year. So run, pass, or kick. What can help a sevens player like these guys be successful crossing over into a 15s code?
Run, I'd say he needs to understand the game. Sevens and 15s are two totally separate games. You're both playing rugby, but the sort of things you're expected to do on the field are totally different. Now, if you're going to get Carlin Isles, in sevens, you know, you can have 6 players who clear space for him and then give him the ball and tell him run. That's all you have to do. Just run straight and run past people and score. If you're playing at number 14 or number 15, I'm saying that purely because of his size. I don't know what his other skill set is. You have to run a defense. You have to run, you know, all sorts of things that happen on the rugby pitch. If you don't understand those intricacies of the sport, then it'll be a bit difficult for you to get onto the park and play because, you know, here you're not just that there are 14 other guys on the field,
Did we lose him?
I'm not sure. I think we might have lost him.
Oh.
See if we can get him back here. Oh. Well, here you go. Ron's back. You were saying there's, you know, you have the other players and you don't have the space. And I think the simple answer though, Ron, is we're going into the Olympic year. Why would he try and go for an MLR contract when he's going to be prepping for his Olympic year?
Well, you've also got to look beyond the Olympics. What happens after that?
Mm-hmm.
What if the Olympics, the rumor is it might be canceled again this year. And if it's postponed this year, it's going to be canceled. But anyway, I agree with you. I'd take the Olympics first and say, let's talk about that later. Because that medal, you know, it helps you in your negotiations.
Exactly. So, I think that's my short answer, quick one, just because we lost Ronald. But I do think you're right. I think, he could develop into a great 15s player. And I think, coaches need to take the time to develop these sevens players to play 15s in the professional setting.
And let me throw another rider into that, because in Mike Friday, he's got a fantastic coach. Mike Friday is one of the best coaches I've ever seen. Mike Friday coached Kenya before he came to the United States, right? Mike Friday is a national sevens coach. He coached Kenya before he came to the United States. And then I wasn't there at the time, so I take no responsibility for that. We foolishly kicked him out. Right. And then he came to the States and he got all the space that he needed. And look at the team that he's molded. So a team that was regularly playing in the bowl competitions in the seventh is now actually winning the World Series and is a major force on. It really hates me to say. I really hate it that I have to say this, but it's a major force on the international platform. I remember when I was at KRU and whatever, we had our international sevens tournament, and Mike Friday would show up, and all the people would come and ask me, "Are we going to ask Mike Friday to come back?" And I said no. I think for Kenya to get off to where it's supposed to go, where it can go, we've actually got to kill his ghost, because his ghost haunts us everywhere we go. You know, Mike Friday's around. Mike Friday's around. Come on. But he's a great coach.
But I do understand that you got to like kind of kill the narrative and say it's a new team. It's a new, you know, way, and we're gonna, you know, move on.
Yeah, here you are, 7-8 years later, and you're still talking about him.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he had a huge influence, huge impact on the way rugby is played in Kenya today. He's a real fantastic guy. And if you're listening, Mike, that's my shout out to you, you know.
Well, so that leads to actually very well, Ronald, into the next question. Kenya has produced some incredible athletes. I'm not talking about generally. I mean, obviously well known for long distance runners, middle distance runners, in the track events. Can they produce a sevens team that can be consistently a top team in the World Sevens Series? So as you talk about the United States elevating its game, Kenya elevate its game to that point? So run, pass, or kick. And then as a follow-up, why haven't they been as successful at the 15s game as they have been at the sevens game? So kind of a two-part question there.
Okay, yes, I'll run with that one. Yes, they can produce a team that can play consistently. And the first thing we have to do is to kill Mike Friday's ghost.
Right? I teed it up for you.
Yeah. The first thing we have to do is exorcise that completely, because he brought in a standard, but we've also got to learn to believe that we can actually move on from there and not keep going back to where he was. If you think about between Mike Friday and today, there have been about maybe four or five different coaches who have come in. So nobody has really, we're sort of in a situation where we have to keep producing results, and you want results quickly. Right. And if you don't get the results quickly, you give the guy a couple of seasons or a season and a half and tell him, get out of here. You're not helping us very much. Let's pick the next guy. But look at what Mike Friday did when he came to the United States. He came in 2014. This is 2020. But it's taken him, 6 years to build the powerhouse that he has right now. And now it's on its way up. And if the Olympics were not canceled last year, the U.S. was in the running for a gold medal in the Olympics. I mean, they now challenge Fiji regularly, the South Africa, they challenge New Zealand. Yeah, all the top sevens teams, they challenged them without fear. Before that, it was like, we're playing the U.S., not a problem, we'll beat them and then we'll move on. Now you don't do that. That's what Kenya needs to do. And then to go to your second question, why hasn't that translated to the 15s? Well, in a way, it boils down to, first of all, how we manage our sport. And then secondly, our development track isn't so good. Right? Our development structure isn't so good. It's creaking, trying to get in place. And one of the challenges we face is you get a partner, you get a sponsor who wants instant results. So you keep trying to give him what he wants, as opposed to focusing on building your structure so that you're consistently producing the same, you know, top class players. But I can give you your day in the sun today, but then tomorrow it's going to be a totally different thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. I really appreciate those insights, especially into a union that maybe some of our fans aren't as familiar with and that they should be on the lookout for, because certainly Kenya has been able to produce, those results, in various tournaments. But as you say, they need to build the consistency a little bit more. Yeah. We're going to lighten it up a little bit. Now it's time for our quick tap, and we're just going to rapid fire give you some choices here. First one up, a better tournament, speaking of sevens, a better tournament, Hong Kong sevens or Cape Town sevens?
Hong Kong.
Okay. I thought you'd say that. All right. More iconic, the English Rose or the Silver Fern?
Silver Fern.
Okay. You play this hard and fast, just like you coach, Ronald. More likely to win a three-match series right now, today, if it could be played, Springboks or All Blacks?
I'd say I pass on that one.
Well, I mean, we haven't seen South Africa. So, I mean, we haven't seen them play in a while. So I can see that.
That's why I pass on that one, because I know teams come back from the dead to play the All Blacks. So just because you haven't seen them doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. It's funny because Faf de Klerk commented, I think, this week on that. He said, we'll just get back together. We'll have a couple practices. And I think we've got enough of a team chemistry to gel and come together pretty quickly. So that's not out of the bag for them. Better scrum half, speaking of Faf, Faf de Klerk or Antoine DuPont?
I'd say Faf de Klerk.
Okay, Ty would give you a big hug right now if you were here. all right. The GOAT, the greatest of all time, Richie McCaw or Dan Carter?
I pass.
It's a tough one.
They play two different positions.
Yeah.
They had different skill sets, obviously, and they certainly they were appreciated and loved and revered for very different reasons, right? Okay, last one here. Which did you enjoy more, coaching men's club rugby or women's club rugby?
Women's club rugby.
And you, can you give us a little context as to what you enjoyed about that?
Because when I left,
I have to get the dagger out of my practice.
When I left the Blaze, I took a couple of maybe a year or so off. Then I decided to get back into the game, and I went and coached the women's rugby team, Chicago Sirens Women's Rugby Club, and that was the greatest coaching experience I've ever had. Because when you're coaching men, men seem to know everything. They have all the answers. So when you're coaching them, when you're talking to them, they're already shaking their heads. Yeah, even if they don't quite understand. And the women actually listen to what you're saying. Think about what you're doing. When you explain something, once they understand it, then they'll run with it forever. They actually taught me to think about the game differently from the way I knew it. Right. So, and once we got our act together, then we started beating everybody else that we used to play against. And then it moved slowly once again from being a social team to a lot more competitive team. When we first started, like I said at the beginning, we started with six players, but we'd struggle to play every weekend. And it was a problem. Everybody got to play. When we were only 15 people, there was no chance of anything. The moment we got player number 16, life changed. It became different because now we had to start making selection, put A or B, and then it grew that way. They were a real fun side. I took them to Kenya.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, we went and played in the Safari Sevens. That was a fantastic trip.
See, I think there's the subtle meaning to that. Rob, you're dumb. That's pretty much it. He didn't want to say it, but that's what he said. That's how I took it. Is coaching Rob is hard because he's dumb.
I think my wife must have gotten back into a couple training sessions because Ron has clearly been, they've been conversing.
He's digging it in. So we're back to the RPK, and Ron, I have a question. Players have gotten bigger, they've gotten stronger, they've gotten faster, they've gotten more professional in the past 25 years. As a result, defensive structures have gotten better and more difficult to break down. Run, pass, or kick. Does world rugby need to change any laws to create a more exciting game of rugby? And if you think so, do you have like one or two recommendations you would make?
Ron, the question would be, what is more exciting? You need to define that.
Well, that's the tough part. Cause me, if England plays South Africa and the final is 6-3, I feel like we had an exciting match as long as there wasn't a lot of, drop passes, but I mean, some people might say, some people might say scoring. I guess that's the whole point of how rugby league in the Southern Hemisphere, right, is creating their rules is to create more scoring. So let's use the parameter of scoring is exciting.
Now, if you want to make rugby exciting, then you go on another track again. Are you playing sevens or are you playing 15? Sevens for the flashy part, for the fun and the running and the scoring and all that. And it's short, sharp, and it's a big festival that goes on. Or are you going to be a rugby purist and say, let's play proper 15s rugby and see how it goes and see people grind it out? Now, depending on the way the laws are set, depending on if you're playing the Northern Hemisphere or Southern Hemisphere, there are different interpretations that are given. So in the Southern Hemisphere, when you're playing in the Super Rugby and all that, they give a lot of license to running the ball and they allow you to play the advantage as many times as possible. And it could be because of the weather at that point in time. If you go to the Northern Hemisphere where they're playing in the winter and it's muddy and stuff and everything, so your game is a lot more tactical in a sense. I'm not saying the Southern Hemisphere is not as tactical, but it's a lot more tactical where you're now thinking we actually need to gain some ground before we can move forward, because every day it's raining, the pitch is wet, it's muddy. So what do you do? And then your officiating of the sport now is you're focused a lot more on, I don't want anyone to drown in the pools of water on the stuff. Let's not think about the international level of playing, because there the fields are fantastic and everything. But if you go down to the clubs where they play on those little pitches and everything, it may not be as exciting as well, because there. But anyway, people like rolling around in the mud. We did a lot of that at the Blaze, and
those are always my favorite matches. I mean, if I came up looking just completely muddy, I always had a smile on my face. I mean, I think
the other thing they could do is I don't know whether I should say this now, you actually need to promote a lot more women's rugby than is happening right now. It's growing really, really quickly. And it's got so much potential, right? So much potential. And they're getting faster and they're getting better in their skills. So it's like women's soccer in the United States.
I tell you what, I was, when Preston was a senior, we took him down to Nash Bash. Our team down in Nash Bash, and they actually had Life play. Well, they might have played Davenport women's, mm-hmm. and it might have been the most enjoyable game for me to see mm-hmm. at you know the amateur level. Mm-hmm. Really strong, excellent skills, really powerful. I mean, some of the Life players just devastating runners. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I have to agree with you, and I think as we attract more women to the sport, we're going to get a better brand of rugby out of the women's game, and it'll be so enjoyable for fans to watch, for sure.
And here's another thing. They're not fragile. That's the thing that people think that women are fragile. And I thought that when I started coaching the Chicago Sirens, until one day I held a tackle bag for them, and there's a girl called Mary who ran into me, and I thought, okay, that's not light.
Well, right? they're
as hard as everybody else, but we tend to think that they're not fragile. They're just as hard as everyone. Physiologically, you have to adapt to a number of things, but it's a fantastic game to watch.
And I think you're starting to see that build up because we have two other Rugby Canada women who just went over to start playing in the Premiership on the women's side. So, I mean, you're starting to see them move across the professional landscape, and specifically from North America to go across the pond when, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, that really wasn't the case. So I think you're starting to see that build up.
Yeah, absolutely. The next question, we're going to get a little bit back to international rugby and the men's side of things. I think the big news that is starting to trickle out is there's some questions about whether or not the Lions are going to be able to play the scheduled matches in South Africa this summer. In 2021, it has been called into question as a result of obviously COVID, particularly affecting South Africa. Recently, Sky Sports published an article that cited three possible options. I'll give you the three options. You don't need to go back and read the article. Run, pass, or kick. Which option do you think is the best option of three? So here are the options. Pick the best one, run, pass, or kick. Should they postpone the Lions tour to South Africa until 2022? Should they play without fans in South Africa, or should they play the matches in the UK and have South Africa come to the UK?
Run, you postpone it till 2022. The Lions is all about the tour. Lions are a touring side. They don't play at home. They play away. So playing the Lions in the UK is not, it's not like playing in New Zealand or South Africa or Australia. Two, if you don't have fans, the traveling fans for the Lions are up to 30,000 people.
Yeah.
Up to 30,000 people. Now, you go play in a stadium with nobody. Look at the NFL today. Look at the NBA. They're playing with nobody in the stands, right? They're piping in sounds and everything, but there's basically something missing. What are you going to do with all those 30,000 guys? I'm actually on the tour to South Africa I want to go. I don't wanna sit at home and watch them playing on the telly because, you know, there's a thing. So what I would do is I'd postpone it. But then you postpone it, then there are all sorts of contractual issues that come into play that you have to think about and stuff. It's not an easy question to answer. No. But primarily you play with people in the Lions are about fans in the stands, traveling fans, a traveling team, and the Lions are a touring side. They don't play at home.
Me and Rob, I'm going to ask the last two questions, and we're actually going to skip the last two questions we had written down because we just got two really good fan questions that I want to share. So this first one is from Cy, and he says, should Rugby Africa try to attempt a Pan-African continental club competition like SLAR? You know, it wouldn't need South Africa, but elevating some nations like Kenya, Nigeria, Madagascar to have professional clubs to represent them. Do you think that would be a good idea to try and get that together as a competition?
Run, actually, that was tried a while ago. It didn't work. They first of all tried to create a composite team. It was only played once, where they took the best players from different countries, brought them together as a composite side, and went to play a team in South Africa. that didn't work. Then the second thing was what Rugby Africa has done is, as well, it holds annual competitions between the different countries. You have the North playing the North and the South playing the South, and then they come together. I think there are five countries in two different pools, five countries each. They play each other one off, and then they come together and play. I don't think it was held last year, but they play it every other year. And the big challenge they have is actually just travel and finance, because it costs a hell of a lot of money to travel up and down the continent. So like Kenya, we were in the same pool as Namibia, Zimbabwe, Uganda, I think, and Zambia. I can't remember the fourth team or the fifth, and Madagascar as well. So you travel around, play all those teams. That trip is sponsored by Rugby Africa, who get their sponsorship from World Rugby. And then if you win your pool, then you go and play the guys who are playing up north, Nigeria, Morocco, Tunisia, can't remember whether it's Mali or somebody, those are the countries. Then the winner of that tournament then goes to the Rugby World Cup. Yeah. Then the second one goes into a repechage with the losers of the other tournaments, continentally, countrywide. You win that one, four countries, you head into the World Cup as well.
Essentially you're doing it off Rugby World Cup years anyway. So essentially you were kind of already doing it, just not under the guise of quote unquote a professional.
Yes.
Competition. So that's great. I love that question. Thank you, Sai. And then the last question we have from our buddy Sam Upman, and I'm gonna change this. So he said could, and I'll change it to should MLR teams look to African countries like Kenya, Zimbabwe, and Madagascar for great athletes with rugby backgrounds that are just missing the professional support system to come play on these MLR teams?
Yes, they should. But then at the same time, what is MLR looking for? They've got to be very clear about what they want, because you can't just show up and say, I'm looking for guys. You'll have 100 people show up. They've got to be very clear. Then you have a scouting process. Let's look for these players. All the professional stuff that people are going to do. I mean, it's a buyer's market, so to speak. It's free enterprise. You're selling your labor. Go for it.
So it sounds to me, Ronald, like you're actually putting your name in the hat to be a scout in Africa for Major League Rugby. I'm your assistant, so let me know when we start. Sorry.
Yeah.
I think the downfall is obviously right now not having a scouts to be in that area. But secondly, we've already seen people like Drew Mitchell have trouble saying to get a visa, saying I'm a professional rugby player. So I can just imagine how a Kenyan rugby player might have a hard time, quote unquote, proving that too, to get the visa. So I think actually the biggest obstacle might be trying to get the visa after they identify the person. But I mean, you know, anywhere you can find a quality rugby player, I think MLR teams should be looking there.
Well, some of those countries that were mentioned, we've got people who've gone to play in France, they've gone to play in England, they've gone to play in New Zealand. People always come up, they look at those matches that I was talking about, and they'll pick a guy and they'll say, can you come out and try for us? So we've had guys they pick people out of the Seventh Circuit and they're approached, come and try out, let's see how it works. A number of Kenyan players have gone and played professionally abroad, so MLR, you know, the opportunity is there.
Now I'm gonna ask one more question. This one's gonna be a quick one, but I love the question because I wrote it. Currently, France is playing extremely well, narrowly losing to England with what many perceive to be a second 15. Rugby World Cup 2023 is in France, just around the corner. Right now, are they the odds-on favorite to win the Rugby World Cup, or is Scott Ferrara out of his damn mind?
I think it's a bit too soon to tell. The French blow hot and cold. They blow hot and cold. England, I think, is rebuilding in an interesting manner. We haven't seen South Africa yet. They're still trying to get their act together because of the pandemic. New Zealand is in the throes of some experiment I can't quite understand. Australia is also struggling to get out of where they are now. So those are the five who you normally think could go and win the World Cup. So it all depends on how we approach this pandemic thing, if you ask me. Because I think the Six Nations is supposed to be going on, and the French are saying you can't come unless you can offer all sorts of guarantees of security. Mm-hmm. and health and stuff like that. So how we manage this period of time is really, really critical to how we get to the World Cup in 2023.
No, I agree. It's definitely too early to be like an odds-on favorite. I just felt like France seemed to have their act together when they decided, hey, we're cutting loose some of these older guys. We're bringing up these young kids now to create. And I think they'd rather last year they were taking, or 2019, they were taking the losses, knowing that we're bleeding our young players early to prep for that 2023 World Cup. So I think it seems usually France seems to really don't have a plan, and they seem to have a plan for this one. So that's how I felt that
that's today. Today. They seem to have a plan today. Tomorrow they may not.
That's true. Well, I got to be honest, this has been really eye-opening for me. I hope it's been eye-opening for the Rugby Rant fans, because we talk about, obviously we talk about North American rugby, but, the similarities of you creating the Kenyan Rugby Union and Rob and I and Ty speaking to guys who created the MLR and who own these teams, and to see what you have to do at the start, what you have to do to develop, what you have to do to get a product on the field. I mean, and you're talking about it with the club team, like the Sirens, starting out with six people. I mean, it all equates, and I appreciate you coming on the show, Ron. I had a lot of fun. We got a lot of fan interaction actually in the chat, and all the SAFAs are going crazy because we're talking about African rugby. So it was great. Our buddy Marquise, Goodwin was just said, he actually is like, does Ron have a Facebook? I have some questions. I want to Facebook him. And I was like, unfortunately, Ron does not. I had asked that, we asked that previously because he's so knowledgeable that I kind of want to be, picking his brain a little bit more off, but that's off topic anyway. I'm gushing a little bit. Ron, thank you so much. I appreciate it. This was a great run, pass, or kick, everybody. And please, guys, we have a new Rugby Rant coming out on Sunday, so check out the new episode 34, coming out on Sunday. I'm the big guy, Scott Ferrara. That's Rob the Hammer Hammerschmidt. And for our buddy Ty, who couldn't be here, thank you so much, and have a great night.
Thank you, everyone.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.